So this is a very short summary of a very long paper, 60-page essay, that looks into questions of democratic inclusion principles. The question that I ask in the title of the short presentation is, who has a claim to be included in the democratic polity? And the answer is very simple and short. That depends on what you mean by inclusion. So what I'm going to argue is that political theorists have tried to answer this question by assuming that all inclusion means being included as a citizen in the demos. And I think this is wrong. We ought to differentiate it between different questions about inclusion, and we ought to find inclusion principles that answer to these specific questions. And these answers ought to be compatible, but there will be also some tensions between the principles that answer these questions. That's in a way the general claim. I have prepared a handout, 20 theses in that handout. I won't present all of this. I will skip part of what I call the background assumptions for the sake of time, and also on Olivier's advice, I will focus mostly on section 3. Section 4, I thought, was the most appropriate for the topic of this colloque because it talks about citizenship beyond the state. But I will stick to section 3, and if I have time, I will just tell you what's going to come in section 4. So, this starts from a problem that has been much discussed in political philosophy. Also, the colleague here, Elena, has contributed to this debate. It's called the democratic boundary problem. I will just summarize my conclusions of this debate rather than diving deep into the argument. The first conclusion is that when you conceive of democracy in a procedural sense, when you think that popular sovereignty is a matter of procedure, as for example also Jürgen Habermas thinks, then that question, who belongs to the polity, cannot be answered. It is impossible to define who ought to be included in the demos if we think about democracy in purely procedural terms. There are other conceptions that say, well, we need to refer to an entity that exists prior to democracy, the pre-political conception of the demos, and that resolves the problem. And some of these theorists say the only pre-political entity that can form a demos in history is the nation. So you have to refer to nationhood as something that is prior to democracy and provides a condition for developing democracy. That answer, I think, is coherent, but it's unattractive. It's normatively deeply unattractive in an age in which nation states are increasingly interdependent, and in which there are contexts of migration where it is not obvious who belongs to which nation, and people may find themselves excluded from democracy on grounds of their migratory conditions of existence. So I think what we need instead is substantive inclusion principles that can be argued to be democratic in substance, not just in procedure. And there are two such principles that have been discussed widely by political philosophers. They're called the principle of including all affected interests and the principle of including all those subject to government coercion. In the initial stages of the debate, theorists assumed these were the same principles. Now I think there's a general recognition that they actually lead to quite different conclusions. And therefore, people see them as rival answers to the question of democratic boundaries and inclusion. The problem I'm going to argue is that these two principles serve better the purpose of contesting the existing boundaries than of legitimating alternative ones. You can easily argue why democracies are in unjust ways excluding some affected interests or those who are subject to their coercion. It is much more difficult to use these principles constructively to say how else should the boundaries of a demos be constituted on grounds of these principles. The problem that both principles suffer from is what I call circular reasoning that uses an output of the democratic process in order to determine its input. An output of the democratic process is the policies that are adopted by a government or by a parliament. That's the output of the process. If you then say you ought to include all those who are affected, whose interests are affected by these policies, in the demos, that elects the parliament, that adopts these policies, you end up in a circle. The output determines the input by saying who is included in the democratic process. The same is true if you say that, no, it's not about the policies, it's about the institution of government that coerces some people by subjecting them to their laws and institutions. Again, if you start with the government that coerces a population, you cannot arrive at the conclusion by who belongs to the people by saying, well, these are the people. That leads to the strange and perverse conclusion that the people are actually created by the government. And the people is supposed to authorize the government that creates the very same people. This is a bit like Bert Brecht's famous saying after the uprising in Eastern Germany in 1953, if the government is dissatisfied with the people, why don't they dissolve the people and elect a new one? This is not how democracy works. So what we need to do instead, this is what I suggest, is we need to cut this circle and stretch it into a linear sequence of stages of the democratic process. The democratic process starts with a people authorizing a government to govern. That government, if it's properly authorized, has the power to adopt policies. And these policies will affect interests. But it's not the case that those who are affected by those interests are necessarily the very same people who can authorize the government in the first place. If we cut the circle and stretch it into a line, we end up then with three different questions. The first one is, who has a claim to inclusion in the demos? The second one is, who has a claim to protection by the government she or he is subjected to? And the third one is, which interests must be taken into account when governments take policy decisions? So these are the three questions. And I think that there is no single meta principle of inclusion that allows us to answer all of these questions. We have to look for individual different principles to address each of these questions. These principles must be compatible with each other, but they need not be the same principle altogether. So let me go through the three questions still in reverse order. It's easier to start at the end of the process by looking at what is the proper role of affected interests in democratic politics. And what I said, I start with assuming, and that's part of the background assumptions that I have no time to explain, that we live in a world with bounded polities that have limited territorial jurisdiction and a demos that elects legislators. So the problem is that some decisions taken by this legislator affect interests of some people outside the territory, and those decisions do not equally affect all inside the territory. Policies have unequal impact inside the territory and they have external spillover effects outside the territory. So where does what do we do then with this diagnosis? That the output of the policy process is not equal and not confined to the citizenry. The answer is, I think, that a legislator, a democratic legislator, has to take these interests into account. And it must be the interest that would actually be affected by a decision that is on the agenda of the legislator. The affected interest cannot determine the agenda, because then that would lead back to the circle. But once an agenda has been adopted by a democratic legislator, the legislator has a normative obligation to take affected interests into account before the decision is taken and implemented. So that's a moral requirement for the legitimacy of policy decisions, that affected interests are not just ignored. Now, there is a way how affected interests are recognized in democratic politics. That political philosophers really think about, and it's called civil society. And civil society and media feed back into the democratic process while the legislators are negotiating and discussing what policies they ought to decide. There are interest groups, there are lobby groups, there are people demonstrating for or against a certain policy. And all of these are things that legislators ought to pay attention to and very often also do pay attention to as long as they happen inside their jurisdiction, because they think this might also shape in the next election in a way. So they are attentive to these interests And they do so, and sometimes they have consultations over law with these organizations, and that shapes, in a way, the policy outcome in the end. And this is how it ought to be. The big problem is with externally affected interests, because the international state system is designed to shield national governments from being exposed to externally affected interests. They don't have to take them into account. They are not authorized by anybody who is out there who doesn't vote for them. They have to take them into account if the externally affected interests have another form of representation, which is a powerful national government that can weigh in on the democratic process in another state. And if it's powerful economically and it's powerful militarily, it's likely that that other government will have an impact on the policy decision in the state. But that's, you know, something that is normatively very hard to justify. Why should it be the powerful states that have this kind of representation? So I think we have an issue in democratic theory to come up with more imaginative solutions. How could externally affected interests be institutionally represented in the policy-making process of each individual democratic state? And I have a couple of possible answers. You know, we can speculate about this. It's not just intergovernmental consultation. There could also be forms of direct delegations of civil society interests around the globe in each parliament that speak in that voice. But the point is, these representations of externally affected interests are different from the representation of citizens who authorize the government. It's not the same process because it occurs at the stage when the government is already authorized. It occurs at the stage when it decides on its policies, and this is where the interests come from. So, what about the second principle? The principle of that all subjected to coercion ought to be included in the demos. That looks more plausible because you could assume, well, these are the people living in the territory. They are exposed to the law that is adopted by the government for a certain territory. And you could also say that's more plausibly rooted in a conception of a democracy that says the task of the government is to secure the conditions for individual autonomy of those whose autonomy it coercively restricts. In a way, a Rousseauian idea, you know, that we can be free only under a coercive government, we can be free if we are those that authorize that government and that participate in self-government. That's the normatively attractive idea behind the principle. However, the principle works only if we distinguish the claim that people who are subjected to coercion have to equal protection under the law from a claim that they also are the very same people that have a claim to membership in the polity. And these two claims are not identical. Let me illustrate this with an empirical argument before I make the normative case for this. Empirical argument, the first part is just think about the first clause of the 14th Amendment of the US Constitution that reads as follows. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So you have a distinction between who is a citizen and who has a right to equal protection under the law. And the right to equal protection under the law goes to all persons who are inside the jurisdiction. It is disconnected from citizenship. So this is what I want to claim, that being subjected to a government gives you a claim to equal protection, and I would add to that a claim to contest. A claim to contest and a right to justification, as Rainer Forst says. This is what being subjected gives you a claim to. It does not necessarily give you a claim to citizenship. Why that? Look at what the situation is empirically. If you go for that principle, you would say that all people in the territory should automatically be citizens because they are subjected to the territorial jurisdiction. And once they leave the territory, they should automatically cease to be citizens. This is not how democracies actually operate, because what we have is a condition where people who are foreign nationals take up long-term residence, have a claim to naturalization, but they must apply for it. There is no more automatic naturalization of people who are resident in the territory. Secondly, most citizens, all of you, get citizenship at birth. It's not actually premised on even being present in the territory in most cases, but it's certainly not based on the idea that you will be subjected for the rest of your life to that sovereign. It's a circumstance of birth that determines whose state's citizen you are. And you can even pass on your citizenship, and that holds also for France, for next generations born abroad. How does that match with the principle of subjective, of including all subjects to the jurisdiction? Finally, non-citizens can nearly never vote in national elections. They are not part of the demos unless they are naturalized. So how come? How is that possible? The answer I'm trying to give is that there is a third principle that answers to what was originally the first question on the list. Who is a claim to be included in the demos? And I call this the citizenship stakeholder principle. It's a difficult term because people misunderstand stakeholding as being interested in the policies. I think of stakeholder membership as being interested in being a member of a polity. And my general answer to that is we have to think about the interest that individuals have in their own freedom or autonomy and their own well-being as corresponding to the collective interest that citizens have in the collective flourishing of a polity and the collective self-government of the polity. So these two things correspond to each other, and those individuals whose individual circumstances of life make their autonomy and well-being dependent on the collective autonomy and well-being of a particular polity have a claim to be included in that polity as citizens. That's the general formula. I'm aware this is not a mechanic formula that you can easily just translate and say, okay, you are in and you are out. What you actually have to do, and this is would be the fourth part, is you have to apply that idea by asking a series of questions about the conditions for membership in different types of polities. In states, in the international state systems, the condition is generally one of birthright membership because these states are organized in a way that people need to be able to carry to have their citizenship secure and for life and by birth. This is how the international state system works, and if you do away with this, you put people in jeopardy. And it's migrants who would suffer most from a different allocation rule of citizenship in that international system. They need to retain their citizenship when they move abroad, and they need to be seen as applying for a new membership when they take up residence in a new host country. So, and what birthright citizenship moreover does in that system, it provides ultra stability. It signals to people that you are a citizen by birth, and this is why citizenship is something that stretches across generations. You ought to take the interests of future generations into account because you have not chosen your citizenship. You are part of a chain of generations and you're born into your citizenship. That goes for states. But there are different types of polities, and a different type of polities, for example, municipalities. Below the level of the state, if you think what citizenship could mean and actually means in an increasing number of states at the local level, it is not about birthright, it is about residence. You become a citizen of the city by taking up residence, and you lose that status when you move abroad. Outside the territory of the municipality. And the fact that 12 European member states today and 8 Latin American states give local voting rights to anybody who is a long-term resident independent of their nationality, to my mind, is an expression of local citizenship. This is just institutionalizing what it means to be a local citizen, and it means just to be a resident and nothing else. And finally, you have a third type of citizenship, which is a citizenship in an entity that is constitutionally linked with another level. This is both for federal states true, and it applies also in the European Union in an inverse way. If you have member states that constitute a political union, which is called the European Union, then the two citizenships are linked in such a way that EU citizenship is derived from your member state nationality. Again, there are many people who criticize this and said anybody who is a resident should be automatically a citizen of the European Union. But this would undermine the idea that the Union is constituted by its member states and by the nationals of the member states. Asserting this derivative link is actually a strength because it enables to stabilize the Union as such. The same is true in federal states, where it goes the other way around. Because you are a citizen of the Federation, as in the 14th Amendment, sorry, you are also a citizen of the state where you reside. So this links the two things together. So I have no more time to speak about my beautiful tables that explain why three principles, although the way I've tried to reformulate them, I think this makes them compatible with each other, there are also tensions between them. The tensions that I cannot explain now, I think, can only be overcome by translating the kind of normative legitimacy that I've talked about, which means applying all the three principles simultaneously into empirical legitimacy. Mm-hmm. That's the hardest task. That's not a philosophical task, that's a political task. It means that democracy is legitimate when the people themselves accept the three inclusion principles as expressing what kind of democratic people they want to be. And the answer to that cannot be possibly a nation. It will be something else. It will be an identity that is built on a multi-level idea of citizenship that embraces all three inclusion principles. Thank you. For